Now it's time for the Southern Cross.
Radio. So Southern Cross is back with me in studio, and I have Pacific Media Watch contributing editor Michael Andrew with me. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Good. So this week we've got a few things to talk about, a little bit less sort of election driven this time, mm-hmm. which is nice to change it up a little bit. So last week police raided the house of News Corp journalist Annika
Smithhurst
in Canberra and ABC headquarters in Sydney. Can you tell us more about this?
Yes. So this was definitely the biggest and most alarming story last week. So it was two separate raids, the first of which was a domestic raid on a News Corp journalist, Annika Smithhurst, in her home in Canberra. And basically it was motivated by a story she had written based on a 2018 plan by the, I can't remember the name of the agency, but it was a plan to basically put Australian citizens under surveillance. And so they raided her home, and she works for the Australian, and basically it was a big scandal because the story was deemed in the public interest. It was a very important story. And her employers at the Australian pulled down their paywall so that the world
could
actually see
them.
These stories and actually get it out there. So it was quite a concerning development.
So police raided
so
the
it
house
was Australian Federal Police. And they were acting on behalf of tip-offs from government agencies. What's the name of this outlet? It's the Directorate. One of the agencies is actually coming up with this plan to monitor Australian citizens, and she did a story on it. And so the police raided her home in search of information and evidence, I suppose, to prosecute her.
My goodness.
But the other one, and probably the more concerning one, is the very public raid on the ABCs, the Australian Broadcasting Commission, was kind of like the Australian version of RNZ, their headquarters in Sydney. This was in broad daylight, and this was based on leaked information from an interior source about the Australian military's misconduct in Afghanistan a few years ago.
Oh, wow.
So one person has already been prosecuted for that, but basically the Australian Federal Police were after information, presumably evidence to detect the identification of the source or sources. So very concerning, but it was well publicised, and we actually had a student journalist from the University of Technology in Sydney, or actually a few student journalists who managed to walk, because their uni is, the campus is right next to the ABC's headquarters.
Oh, really?
They were able to actually see this unfolding and monitor it and record it, and their material was actually being distributed around the world. So it was great work of student journalism.
That's awesome.
Taking pictures and video and keeping the world updated. And they had some pretty prominent news outlets from overseas requesting information and requesting to you. So a big shout out to student journos for covering that, because that's
awesome.
Really good achievement. But the concerning thing about all this is that the police in both cases were acting legally. So they had legitimate warrants, because the Australian government introduced legislation a few years ago which made it harder for journalists to report kind of these contentious public interest stories that compromise alleged national security issues. So they basically they passed these three pieces of legislation, the first being the National Security Amendment Act in 2014, which basically said journalists could get sentenced to 10 years in prison if they published anything about Australian government covert operations.
What?
So that's the extent of the crackdown on public interest journalism.
So when they're like going in there and going into the ABC headquarters, and so they're going in there looking for information, but what's happening to the staff? And so what are they, what do you know, what sort of, are those people, are those like the journalists in ABC and the people working for ABC, are they sort of concerned about what, with that legislation, like whether what their sort of criminal liability is because of that?
Absolutely. I mean, the Australian journalists in the ABC, they were sending updates and Twitter updates about what was happening. So they weren't detained in any way. They were free to report on what was happening to them. But yeah, you can only imagine that they would be incredibly concerned that a story which logically and rationally is an immense public interest.
Yeah, and it should be the right of the public to know that sort of thing completely.
For sure, like, especially in a democracy like Australia. I mean, yeah. So you can only imagine that they would have been very concerned and very...
conflicted. Like, conflicted. It's sort of a really sort of, yeah, moral, ethical sort of what do I do? Do I, like, protect myself or do I work, if you know, under my purpose and work actually as a journalist and report on what people need to know?
Exactly, and that's the conundrum with journalism in general, especially investigative journalism, and especially investigative journalism in the Pacific, because countries like Australia and New Zealand typically should have that freedom to report on government abuses of power, on corruption, on human rights violations, on these things that are in the public interest to create an informed and enlightened democracy. But in the Pacific, they don't have that luxury. We should have that luxury. Actually, New Zealand has a quite an interesting little piece of legislation as well, whereby if someone from inside a government agency reveals information to a journalist, there is cause for prosecution if it is compromising national security issues.
Oh,
so
wow.
New Zealanders aren't actually free; don't have total immunity and impunity to report on these types of issues. So, yeah, it does prompt some questions.
Yeah, and I suppose doesn't set a good precedent for moving forward in sort of the smaller Pacific nations either, does it?
The bigger
ones that sort of you should expect have more sort of freedom in that way just don't, which is,
it's intimidation, really. It's pretty scary, and it does make journalists question whether they can do the job or should do the job. So, but we'll see what happens.
So let's move on. An update about Peter O'Neill. He's officially resigned.
Yes.
Tell us more about this.
Yeah, so he officially resigned after a period of kind of, just making a lot of noise as possible and making a lot of confusion. So he didn't go quietly, as they say. Eventually he did officially announce his resignation. So that was not last week, but the week before.
Mm-hmm.
And his opponent, James Marape, was elected unanimously to become the next leader. So he was sworn in. And since, he has basically said all the right things. He's announced that he wants change, and he detects and acknowledges the desire for change in Papua New Guinea, the desire for less corruption and for more focus on what's actually happening with the Papua New Guineans and their land and their entitlements and their rights. And he's also brought in with him a cabinet of quite reformist politicians, so ones that used to be in the opposition and were stern and outspoken critics of Peter O'Neill's government. He's brought them in and given them quite high-profile positions in cabinet. It is a great gesture of his intent to change. Pretty much, I mean, he's in his opening address, he did, it was quite a charismatic and really well... spoken speech that touched on a lot of issues. I mean, they're just words at this stage.
Yep.
But yeah, he, for instance, Peter O'Neill created this external corruption agency to investigate elements of corruption within the government. But then they found that Peter O'Neill was being corrupt and went to arrest him, and he totally disbanded it.
Break
it up. But Marape is basically saying, I'm going to reinstall this, and it needs to hold everyone accountable. So,
sounds like it's moving in a good direction, but I suppose, yeah, we'll see.
Yes.
Yep.
We shall see.
Talking a little bit about the Solomon Islands, Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison and New Zealand Deputy Prime Minister Winston Peters made separate visits to the Solomon Islands, both announcing more aid and funding. And I understand that there's a little bit of thought about what the reason might be behind those moves. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So Solomon Islands has been in the news particularly because they are currently allied, or they recognise Taiwan as an official government, one of a small number of countries that do.
Yeah.
And they're the biggest country that recognises Taiwan officially. So they get a lot of foreign aid and they have close diplomatic relations, but it was reported that they're under pressure to switch allegiances to China,
who's
obviously not in favour of Taiwan being recognised or their existence in general.
Mm-hmm.
So as soon as that story broke, it was around the same time as the Australian election, and then Scott Morrison announces his first overseas trip is to the Solomon Islands. So naturally people are going to draw conclusions that Chinese influence in that region is prompting a visit from a high level, Australia's leader. And as he got to the Solomon Islands and he announced that Australia would be upping the funding and foreign aid and a couple of hundred million, some huge figure, and that adds to the $3 billion Australia's already earmarked for developments in the Pacific, and basically opened up the doors to mobile workers from the Solomon Islands if they want to come into Australia. So very favourable announcements for the relationship between Australia and the Solomon Islands. And similarly, on a visit later in the week, Winston Peters, who's visiting the whole of Melanesia right now, he announced that New Zealand aid would continue and New Zealand is keen to try and nurture that relationship as much as possible with aid and with resources. And
so is that that thought about the relationship with China, is it the sort of the idea, and then with Australia and New Zealand sort of now sort of showing that they're going to give aid into the Solomon Islands, is the sort of the idea behind that is that China, the influence like New Zealand and Australia's relationship with China might have upon the Solomon Islands to change from being so connected to Taiwan? Is that sort of the idea?
Well, in Australia's case, a lot of reports have said it's kind of American influenced. Australia and America are very close allies, yeah, especially in the Pacific. They are strategic military allies in that region, and China is a very clear, they wouldn't say threat, but everyone knows that in a military sense, you have a big player, another big player in the Pacific, it is a threat. So a lot of reporters are saying that's what's prompting Australia's moves to solidify their relationship with the Solomon Islands. But Scott Morrison denies this, of course, as would any leader, to say that it's because of China. But you can draw your own conclusions and you can look at the geopolitical landscape of it all and it just makes sense. However, I think Australia are keen to keep as many allies in that region as possible and keep any kind of bilateral trade going. I mean, it just makes economic sense.
Absolutely.
But yeah, China is their Belt and Road scheme, which is their initiative to develop infrastructure and technology throughout the Pacific. That's had incredible benefits, and it's also been disastrous in certain cases environmentally. It does make the relationships between these Pacific countries and their other allies, such as Australia and New Zealand, more complicated because, your influence diminishes. I mean, I think geopolitically it's just, it's a natural development when you have another massive power with a lot of resources pumping them into these countries. And it just makes it a bit more tricky.
Absolutely. So let's talk a little bit more about pumping money into the Pacific. The New Zealand government a couple of weeks ago announced the 2019 budget. What effect will the new budget have on the Pacific?
Yes, so quite a bit has been earmarked to the Pacific community in New Zealand, which should trickle down to the Pacific community abroad, naturally. But it's a well-being budget, so it's factoring in the well-being of the Pacific, and it's said to try and embrace Pacific values and co-design initiatives within the Pacific community. So a lot of it's going towards the arts, towards languages, health, and business in the Pacific community. It's about $27.4 million over the next 4 years, and it also quite a bit's going towards Pacific students. And their families to provide them with skills and knowledge and opportunities to pursue education. So it's great news, actually. It's
so really it does nice. It does reflect what sort of the Pacific wants out of funding from New Zealand, like, does it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think that there have been people outspoken in the Pacific community saying that that's a community that has been marginalised. Mm. And, yeah, I agree, personally. Yeah. So yeah, it's great that they're getting more attention and more resources, because it's a community that does need it and does need to be nurtured. And Auckland is the biggest Pacific city, you know, with more Pacific people in the world. So it's a inherent part of the city's landscape and character. Mm. It needs to be, and in New Zealand as well. So it does need to be nurtured and developed and embraced, and I think that's what this budget is trying to do. So, yeah, good stuff.
Yeah, a positive outlook for the end. So thank you so much, Michael. Anybody can read all about the Pacific Media Centre updates at asiapacificreport.nz. Thank you so much.
Cheers.
That was the Southern Cross.